Here Be Monsters is a show that invites you to explore fear and the unknown.
I saw her face change. I saw her see where I'd pulled my hair out.
Psychological warfare was always considered kind of an oddity, something done by freaks.
On the count of three, we're literally going to step out of our body. Step out.
You can find Here Be Monsters now at kcrw.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Schneider of IndieWire and Variety, filling in for Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
We'll often sacrifice big dramatic moments on the altar of what feels to us true for the characters and just hope that that has long-term dividends for the show, and I think for this one it has.
Writer-producer Joel Fields believes one of the reasons he and creator Joe Weisberg work so well together on The Americans is their shared pull toward truth over drama. Their creative vision is so in line, they could practically complete each other's sentences. But before embarking on the now Emmy-nominated FX spy series, the two had never before met. Weisberg and Fields tell us how a blind date of sorts led to one of the most critically acclaimed shows on cable. But first, on the Hollywood News Banter, the pressure's on Brad Gray at Viacom's troubled Paramount Pictures. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my partner in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So, Matt, now that the Viacom drama is over, we know who's running the conglomerate. Philippe Dumont is out. Sherry Redstone and her troops are now fully in control, which means we can focus on the properties inside Viacom, most of which have their own troubles. We've talked a lot about the Viacom cable networks, but Paramount, the studio, has its own issues right now.
Yeah, I mean, you saw with Ben-Hur, which cost about $100 million, just a complete flop, opening it to about $11 million. That is not what you want right when the company is in the middle of this corporate drama and everyone is focusing on Paramount. They have a turnaround process to do. And the question is whether they're going to be allowed to do it or whether there's going to be new leadership brought in, maybe a sale of a stake in the company. Philippe Dumont still has a chance to pitch his deal he wants to do to sell a 49% stake in the company to an outside investor. Who knows if that will happen? But bottom line is there needs to be a turnaround effort at Paramount.
Yeah, and obviously it's been a rough year for Brad Gray. When you look at the output of the studio, you mentioned Ben-Hur. Zoolander 2 is also a mess. Whiskey Tango Foxtrot, another disappointment. Even Star Trek Beyond, the only movie out of Paramount this year to gross $100 million, was the lowest grossing Star Trek movie to date. So what do you make about what Brad Gray can do or should do to turn things around?
Well, if I were him, I mean, I would point to the things they have in development. They are being very aggressive about the Transformers franchise and putting into work several films. That is by far their most reliable franchise. They're also doing a number of things to ramp up talent deals. You know, they claim on the lot that they haven't been able to, that they've been sort of handcuffed in the previous years because Viacom was more interested in them managing for profitability rather than box office growth. These are all steps in the right direction. But the question is, you know, with the film business being split into the sort of haves and have-nots, Disney and Comcast, which owns Universal, are the haves. They are investing huge in big franchises like Star Wars and Pixar and all these other things, Illumination and DreamWorks at Universal. They're doing things to create franchises. And what is Paramount going to be able to do to create definite and reliable franchises?
Well, they've got Baywatch coming up, so that's one. We shall see. Speaking of properties that are sort of potentially in transition, Vice and their network Viceland that launched earlier this year took the place of H2, a History Channel that A&E owned. Now A&E is an investor in this new channel, Viceland, which airs lifestyle programming that's all sort of branded in that Vice sort of alternative, unique lifestyle. The ratings are in, though, and the network is actually down 51%. From what H2 was doing. The good news for Vice is that Viceland has actually aged down the network. H2 was an older skewing network with a median age in the 50s. Viceland's down in the 40s. But there is an ongoing question of whether or not a linear cable channel even makes sense for Vice. And the larger issue now going forward, and Shane Smith, who runs Vice, recently talked about at the Edinburgh TV Festival, is does a deal make sense for Disney to just come in and acquire Vice?
Yeah, I think there are a number of issues at play here. First, Vice is a very interesting test case for the new vision for cable networks, where ratings are declining, people are getting content elsewhere, there's a very fractured viewership, and there's an on-demand environment. People are watching what they want when they want it. So what role does that have for a cable network? And you see these cable conglomerates moving away from pure ratings and into more of a branding message. If you talk to Viceland, you talk to the A&E backers of Viceland, they say they're very happy with it. Ratings may be way down from what H2 was, but they are attracting a much younger demographic. And that to them allows them to pitch that channel to advertisers in a unique and special way. I don't know if it makes up for the lack of advertisers. That's something that will ultimately wash out in the financials. But that's at least the argument that they're making. And because everyone in media seems to be chasing this younger millennial audience, the argument is that Disney should just swoop in, buy Vice, and have that be the younger, edgier, more male-focused media company that Disney owns.
Now, of course, we talk about the millennial audience, that younger audience, and as we all know, they're not necessarily watching linear TV. They're on social media. They're on Snapchat. They're on Instagram. They're, of course, on Twitter. And switching gears to the world of social media, Leslie Jones, who a very popular member of Saturday Night Live, recently was in Rio helping out with NBC's coverage of the games. Her website was hacked. Personal photos were published and other personal information as well. And this isn't the first time that Leslie Jones has been attacked by people in social media, but it's never gotten this far. And this raises a lot of questions about stars and social media, Matt.
Yeah, it's just a horrible situation. And I think the takeaway from a business perspective is, you know, it really highlights this challenge that people in the public eye have these days. If you're a star in Hollywood, everyone is encouraging you to have a social media profile, to build up your Instagram and Twitter and Snapchat following. And casting directors and people in the industry are looking at those numbers to gauge how influential you are and how popular you are within the culture. But at the same time, when you put yourself out there and try to build up your brand by being outspoken, you expose yourself to the hatred and racism and sexism and just pure awfulness that there is out there on the internet now. And Leslie Jones is the poster child for this because she is outspoken. She's fun. She stood up to the trolls and said, you know what? You are trying to chase me off Twitter and I'm not going to leave Twitter. And she actually went back on during the Olympics and was so fun and outspoken that she got invited to go to the Olympics by NBC's executive producer. So she was turning that hatred around and trying to take charge. And then someone goes and attacks her and posts personal stuff on her website. It's just an awful situation. I don't know. I don't know the answer.
No, and it's doubly disturbing that, you know, as Hollywood tries to, you know, do better in terms of diversity, that it's some of these diverse stars that are being hit the hardest in social media by folks out there who like to hide behind the anonymity of it all. You know, social media companies like Twitter have been criticized for not working harder in trying to prevent these kind of attacks. But again, no easy answers. But thanks a lot, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, the executive editor of The Hollywood Reporter. The FX series The Americans centers around Philip and Elizabeth Jennings, a married couple who appear to be living an idyllic 1980s suburban life outside of Washington, D.C. But in reality, the Jennings are not American at all. They're Russian spies, deep undercover, so committed to appearing like an all-American family that they've had children, Paige and Henry, who, at the beginning of the series, have no clue what their parents really do for work. The Americans recently wrapped up its fourth season on FX, and through the years, tensions at the Jennings residence continue to mount as their kids get older and their operations require increasingly risky antics. Matthew Reese plays Philip, who, while pretending to be someone else, marries an FBI secretary named Martha. He later makes the decision to send Martha to another location for her own safety. This leads Elizabeth, played by Kerry Russell, to question Philip's commitment to his family and the cause.
If you could go back.
Back? What do you mean back?
With Martha. If our kids were grown and you could just get out of this whole life.
What are you talking about?
Would you go with her?
Both Kerry Russell and Matthew Reese scored Emmy nominations this year, their first for The Americans after a multitude of cries from critics. Our guests today, showrunners Joe Weisberg and Joel Fields, are also Emmy nominees for Outstanding Drama Series and for writing as well. Weisberg created the show, and Fields has been on board as a writer-producer since the very beginning. They're now both executive producers who say they have eerily similar writing habits, plus they're good friends, which is no easy feat when you spend hours upon hours working together. It was the Americans that brought them together. As a matter of fact, Weisberg told us that before the show, they had never even met.
Yeah, it really was a setup. It was a complete blind date. We had the same agent, but had not met that way. And both our agent and John Landgraf, the head of FX, both told us about one another. And then we had a phone date. We had a first phone date where we got on the phone. And I don't remember exactly. I think maybe we talked for 45 minutes or so that first time about sort of the show. And just quickly, it was a good phone date. We started talking about our lives and our families. And I think it was pretty clear that we were going to get along and had a pretty, you know, sort of a similar aesthetic outlook, which proved to be, I think, very key.
And I think also we had a similar process and an approach to working together. I remember in the midst of a very intense first season where a lot of hours were spent together, we took time and really talked about our process and talked about how the relationship was going to work and agreed that we would talk through everything with each other and make sure that we were on the same page as we moved forward. And that took a fair amount of investment early on, but it paid a lot of dividends in terms of the friendship, in terms of the partnership, and in terms of the creative collaboration.
I was going to say, this sounds actually healthier than your average marriage, the fact that you guys actually talked this out and also sort of worked on this relationship early on.
Let me tell you, if Philip and Elizabeth had done this early on, there would have been no show.
Joe, let's talk about you. You did work for the CIA back in the day, but you just didn't ultimately dig it. You know, take us back to what made you make that career change.
There were a number of things for me. You know, having worked there for a while and seen a lot of what was being done, that it seemed not necessarily worth the damage that was being done. So that there were a lot of operations being run, that's sort of the technical way to put it, that I didn't think were of that much value, but that had the potential, or more than the potential, to really damage a lot of people's lives. And I had some real questions about whether or not I wanted to be involved in that. This was not all entirely clear to me at the time. It was sort of forming in my head and becoming sort of clearer as I went along, but clear enough that I wanted to leave.
So take us from that to wanting to become a fiction writer.
Well, I had always been a fiction writer. I'd kept at that in a pretty serious way, really my whole life. So I'd always done that. I'd never really thought that I would do it professionally. But after I left the CIA, I thought, well, what am I going to do next? And having been through that experience, I just, you know, also my father died at that time, and that can really put you through a lot of big emotional changes. And I think that more than anything made me think it's time to really try writing more seriously, which is, in a way, had been my first love. I can't give you an exact count on how many novels I wrote that ended up in the drawer. Not that I didn't send them out, but that I never published until I published the first one called 10th Grade. And then my second one, which was a spy novel. I probably wrote that about 10 years after I left the CIA, when I finally felt that I didn't have to keep the whole thing secret anymore and I could write a little bit something, you know, loosely based on, you know, some things about intelligence. And that book is really what led me into the world of Hollywood, because an agent in Hollywood read it and called me up and said, have you ever thought about writing television? And that's really what led to all of this.
The classic Write What You Know, and that's what led to some of your early credits, like Falling Skies. Joel, let's talk about you now. Wrote some plays, you're a playwright, and then you did a lot of TV movies early on, sort of during the height in the 80s of the TV movie, where all three networks every week had a TV movie, and you did a lot of those.
Well, yeah, that was the time. I graduated from college, and I'd been writing plays since junior high school, and wanted to get into film and television writing. And at that time, TV movies were incredibly exciting, and you could do historical dramas, you could do romantic comedies, you could do a thriller, you could do a political piece. And I got my first job working in the TV movie business and did that for many, many years. And then after all those years, the business kind of went through a constriction. And it also went through a creative constriction where it sort of went from a place where you could do lots of different kinds of things to really they were just making one movie over and over again.
Right, right.
The true crime movie.
Yeah, yeah, the woman in peril mostly.
And then I left the TV movie business and started writing for television, and here I am.
So let's get back into now bringing it all together. So, actually, you already knew the Amblin TV guys. Back then it was DreamWorks. But they came to you and said, hey, we have an idea. You know, these real-life Russian spies who were arrested in 2010, maybe that would make an interesting show. Take it up from there.
And that is exactly what happened. They called me up and they said, look, you're reading the papers. Do you think this would be a good show? And as I somewhat embarrassedly tell the story, I thought in my head, no, I'm not so sure. But what came out of my mouth was, yeah, that sounds great. Let me think about it. So I started walking around LA and just thinking, how would you do a show about that? And a couple things became clear to me over about a week or two of walking. One, that, you know, instead of making some sort of American-centric show with the FBI or the CIA where these guys were the villains, it'd be much more interesting to make them the heroes. And that, two, it should be in the past. That the problem with doing it in the present was that, you know, there really weren't going to be any very interesting stakes. The thing that made it interesting would be in the Cold War. That's when everybody was ready to blow each other to smithereens. And in general, a sort of more, interesting time culturally for what was going on between the Soviet Union and the United States. And I think it became fairly quickly apparent to me that, you know, it was going to give the show sort of an emotional life was having it really centered around a marriage and a family. And, I talk a lot about the fact that one of the really interesting things that I sort of learned and saw a lot of at the CIA was that you had this weird situation where parents lied to their kids about what they did. And then one day, usually when the kids were older, told them the truth. So sort of having that and the family dynamic was something that came to me very early on. So the pieces started coming together and we sold it to FX and developed it there for a very long time, very close, intense, collaborative development process with them. I was working with Amblin. I was working with Graham Yost, who was also involved with the project. And we just spent a lot of time talking about the characters and the conflicts and doing a lot of rewrites on the script and just adding layers and layers of drama and conflict to the story.
It's funny. Often you hear, shows fall apart because there are too many cooks, too many people coming up with different ideas. But this sounds like it sort of worked out having idea coming from the Amblin guys. You had Graham Yost in there, who at the time was successfully producing Justified and was one of FX's favorite producers. And then, Joel, you came aboard.
I had read Joe's pilot and just loved it. And I vowed to my wife that I was going to take at least a year and just develop and not go work on another show. But I had mentioned this one pilot to her, and I got a call from our mutual agent, Joe Cohen, saying that that show had been picked up by FX, but would we be interested in going to New York? Because I'd have to move to New York to do it. And I remember turning to my wife and saying, remember that pilot I told you I loved so much? Would we go to New York to do that? And she just shrugged and said, yeah, sure, that sounds fun. So we were sort of off to the races and then began all of these phone calls that, as you were pointing out, they really did feel like fix-up phone calls.
Yeah.
And then really within weeks, I was in New York and we were working together, writing some new material for the pilot that was going to be parts of it reshot and starting to write those first episodes. And, you know, you talk about the collaboration that went into the pilot itself. Really, I think one of the things that's allowed us to succeed in doing the show together has also been an openness to a greater collaboration. So we have an amazing staff of writers. We have these wonderful actors. We have producing director and all of these people, and we really try to stay open and listen. And on the one hand, we have a very clear idea in our heads of what we want the show to be between the two of us, and also part of what that is being open to this great input from everybody that makes the show sing.
Coming up after a short break, it's TV time travel. The Americans Joe Weisberg and Joel Fields tell us how they leave no 1980s detail unexamined in their renderings of Cold War era USA and Russia. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. KCRW relies on member support to help keep our programming fresh and authentic. Find out how you can donate at kcrw.com/join.
This is The Business, and I'm Michael Schneider, filling in for Kim Masters. We're talking to Joel Fields and Joe Weisberg, the showrunners of the FX show The Americans. In the most recent fourth season, the period drama about the secretive world of Russian spies living in Cold War-era America highlights the relationship between Elizabeth Jennings, played by Kerry Russell, and her teenage daughter Paige, played by Holly Taylor. Paige has gained a growing awareness of her parents' secret lives, and at one point turns to a pastor for guidance. Elizabeth knows her daughter's indiscretion could have a devastating consequence and doesn't hold back when telling Paige what she has to do next.
You are going to find some other shit to volunteer for at that goddamn church so that not a day goes by without you seeing Pastor Tim and his wife. And then you are going to come home every night and you're going to tell me and your father everything that happened, what was said, their moods, their attitudes, their feelings, because that is what is important right now. Because thanks to what you did, that is all that stands between us and this family being destroyed.
Elizabeth and Paige's mother-daughter drama takes place in the kitchen of their Northern Virginia home. Most of the show is set in and around Washington, D.C., and increasingly locations abroad. But the filming for the show is actually done in Brooklyn. Now, talk about New York real quick. The decision to shoot it there, was that a kind of a combination of the tax breaks, the economics of shooting there? But that was also your cast, right? That
was
also
was your mainly, stars. I think it was mainly a combination of Kerry and Russell.
So,
but it's worked out really well for the show also.
You know, Kerry Russell, up until that point, we still knew her best as Felicity, of course. She'd done many other things. But how did you guys zero in on Kerry?
You know, that was really a moment of inspiration by John Landgraf when we were sitting around looking at one of these sort of very long lists of every available female actress in Hollywood who was of the kind of appropriate age. And there was a big group of us sort of looking at this list kind of bewildered. And John Landgraf literally looked up from this giant list and went, Kerry Russell. He says that, you know, just not all the time, but once in a while, he sort of has an intuitive sense of something like that. And he had it there.
And Matthew Rhys?
Leslie Feldman, who is the head of casting for what was then DreamWorks, what is now Amblin, had seen him, I think, in a play and also knew his work pretty well and suggested him. And he auditioned and did a chemistry read with Kerry, and he was just startling and amazing with her.
Yeah, and obviously, I mean, that's lightning in a bottle because that kind of chemistry fell into real life. And obviously, they became a real life couple as well. So clearly something was working. There's some good arranged marriages going on this set. you know, the other thing about the casting is, you know, mostly unknowns for the most part. I mean, you had John Boy as well. So nice to see Richard Thomas again. But talk about finding these actors who are kind of lesser known, a lot of whom needed to know how to speak Russian.
You know, a lot of it was really just our casting department pulling in these amazing people. I mean, the Russians were a bunch of then and have been even more of now. I think started out, it was hard to find a bunch of people, or I don't think the casting people initially were sure how to find those people, but they got good at it fast.
Because we're also very obsessed with accuracy. Mm-hmm. So we wouldn't want someone who's a Polish speaker playing a Russian part. It needed to be Russian. And you imagine, here we are, we're already in production of the first season, and we tell our casting department we need a beautiful woman in her early 20s. It's just a couple scenes in this episode, but we have a major arc planned, and she has to be fluent in Russian. It has to be Russian. And they put us on a Skype with Annette Mahendru.
And the rest is history. I mean, she played Nina on the show, we should say. Has your process, the two of you, changed over the years? Or how is, as your relationship has evolved, how has your writing process evolved?
You know, I've worked with a lot of creative people in my life, and creative people have such weird and odd ways of thinking and working that although it's not uncommon for them to have some similarity or overlap in how they think or how they work, it's very unusual for them to be extremely similar. People's brains are just too different. But Joel and I discovered that the way we write and think and work and produce is very similar. And that's been very helpful and very beneficial to us. And I think what that's the main thing that's then developed over the 4 years we've been making the show, or now in a way 5 years, is that we've been able to streamline our process and get better at it and quicker at it and more efficient at it. And because in many ways, television is about being efficient. It's not just about being creative and coming up with good ideas, but it's about doing that with a great deal of efficiency because you're working against the clock in certain ways. So as we've gotten more efficient, each year we've gotten further ahead on script, giving us more time to re-break the stories and work with our team to get the stories and the scripts ahead of time so we can do more to go back and fix and rewrite and rewrite. And I think it's been one of the key things that's enabled us to make the show better each year.
Joe's answer was so much more thoughtful and eloquent than what popped into my mind when you asked about our creative process, because the thing that excites me about it is that we have a large screen TV that now rotates so that it can go vertically instead of horizontally, and then we can put up an entire page the way a page looks on the screen,
yeah.
Which I think is much more efficient because you can see so much more of the page while you're writing. That was going to be my answer.
I don't underestimate that. I
totally
like that
better.
Too.
Modern technology.
I'll tell you something else that comes to my mind. Joe, you're talking about how we have a creative simpatico, and I think on this show in particular, one of those things is curiously, we both feel more of a pull towards truth than drama. And I think that's been a happy thing for this collaboration on this particular show, because we'll often sacrifice big dramatic moments on the altar of what feels to us true for the characters and just hope that that has long-term dividends for the show. And I think for this one, it has.
Well, and also, speaking of truth and being authentic, we got to talk about the 80s setting as well. And you know, the challenges of setting a show, a period piece, in that, you know, the wardrobe has to be right, the cars have to be right. But also, I'm curious from a budget perspective, is that a challenge? And what does that do for, you know, just producing an hour?
It costs a lot of money. And that's another reason to be ahead on script, so you know what sets you have to build. And another thing that's a challenge is on many shows, you can just go and grab exteriors. But on a period show, your exteriors are really limited because every time we go outside, we have not only to dress with cars, but there aren't phone booths or there are parking meters that are out of period. Or if you're shooting down a street, normally, cars that would go by in soft focus in the deep background, you wouldn't have to worry about. But, you know, you see four minivans go by in deep focus, and that's just not good in 1983.
Yeah, I'll be honest. Every once in a while, I'll look at one of your crane shots, like from way up above, and I'll try to look down at the tiny little cars to see how accurate those cars are. So people are paying attention.
Well, thank you.
Oh, we're so careful about it. And when we miss one, we're devastated. Oh. Once in a while, we'll miss something, and then we'll see it later, or somebody will call us out on it, and Joel and I won't sleep for a month.
That's true. In post-production, if we see it, and we have this fabulous team in post-production, they'll point out the littlest things to us when they find them, and we'll digitally try to take those things out.
You're doing a lot more green screen, too. You went to Moscow this year, and you're going outdoors a little more often.
Yeah, and you know, that's a great example of the collaborative process really working. Some of those exterior Moscow scenes had been written as very production-friendly interior Moscow scenes. And I think the director of one episode and our producing director came back from a scout and said, with some green screen, we can put these characters in Moscow. And so we did.
And we, by the way, we have a consultant in Russia, and we had a, you know, detailed correspondence with him about how to make the park match a park in Moscow in the 1980s. And because the level of detail we're looking for there is we don't really try to just make sure the American audience is okay. We want to have a Russian audience feel that that could actually pass for Moscow too. So we hold ourselves to a pretty high standard with that.
Joel Fields and Joe Weisberg are the executive producers of The Americans on FX. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us. Great talking to you.
You can hear more of our interview with Joe Weisberg and Joel Fields on our KCRW podcast, The Spinoff. And that's the business. Kim Masters will be back next week. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can hear the business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or pretty much wherever you download podcasts. I'm Michael Schneider. We'll see you next time on the business.